Hey, welcome to the Life 2.0 podcast. I am John St. Augustine. Glad to have you joining me from wherever you're listening around planet Earth. Time to go up the down staircase in the outdoor, make sense out of the senseless, and all together now, find the frickin' obvious buried in the absurd. Let's get to it. Glad to be back with you. It's been about 2 weeks, I suppose, since I've fired up the Life 2.0 podcast microphone. As I always say, I don't want to do this on a maintained schedule just because I could do it every Wednesday, every Tuesday, whatever. Something has to move me in order to turn this microphone on. So much of my schedule is built around audio production work, so sometimes the last thing I want to do is talk into the microphone just because. The bridge show that I've been doing for the past year is on hiatus at this point for a while, and we'll see where all that ends up, but that's been an incredibly rewarding experience for me. If you'd have told me back in 2020 that I'd have friends all over the world because of radio, especially my co-hosts in Beijing, China, they've been just incredible people to me. I've learned so much from them and about them over this past year. It's just been a great sidebar gift to this calling that's become a career of mine in radio, going on 25 years now. So that's on hiatus. I have a little bit more time on my hands working on some book projects for friends of mine and other things like that, and actually getting ready to gear up and do the audio version of Every Moment Matters, the second book that I wrote that came out in 2010. Phenomenon is out in audio already. That is at, you can find it on Amazon and Lulu.com and all the kind of places. I should say, I guess you can find it at Lulu, but the easiest way to do it, if you want to get that book, whether it is print, ebook, or audio, my third book, Phenomenon, is go to auroramediaproductions.com. That's my website. Can you believe that for years I had johnstaugustine.com, my name, owned it, and somebody else had built my website, and they neglected, probably 3 years ago maybe, to renew the domain name. And if you don't renew the domain name, somebody can grab it, and then you have to buy your name back from somebody else who doesn't even know who you are. They just know that they have your name. So when that happened, I guess 33 or 4 years ago, as I said, I found out that my domain name was worth about $10,000. Kind of nice to be worth 10 grand on paper, but I'm here to tell you the last thing I'm doing is buy my own domain name back for 10 grand. And over time, because it's not been used, the price keeps getting lower and lower and lower. I could probably buy it for about $1,000 now, but that's not the point. So I created a different site, which just isn't about me, but also the work that I've done, ghostwriting and coaching media and PR and all the things that I've done, the Earth Matters with Bill Curtis, certainly the Bridge stuff there, the Life 2.0 podcast there. And on the main page, when you go to www.auroramediaproductions.com, is a cover of the book Phenomenon. You can just scroll down if you choose to buy the book and get print, ebook, or audio versions. There's links there that will take you to all those different platforms. So that's enough of that. But I'd be getting ready to do the audio version of Every Moment Matters. I got to work myself up to it. That book's 11 years old. There's some changes in my life that may or may not make it into the final audio version. So it's a little bit of a process. But all that aside, I am sitting here very early on the morning of 9/14/21. In my studio, you may hear some background noise because I have all the windows open. It's going to get pretty hot here again in Chicago today. So it's nice and cool here, and I have everything open. And as I look to my left, I'm just starting to see the sun peek over the eastern tree line. And the events of 9/11 20 years ago are stuck in my mind, especially today. Let me just rewind a little bit. A couple days ago, we were all focused on 9/11. And the remembrances and all that goes along with that, I remained a little bit silent for a couple of reasons. One, there was nothing else I could add to the 20-year anniversary, this tragic anniversary that we all experienced here, to change it for one way or the other. You know, we've had remembrances every year since it's happened. Nothing else I could add to that. And I didn't want to take away from it either. So I actually, on Facebook, had written a fairly lengthy remembrance of my day back then, and there was this weird tech glitch, and all of a sudden it was just gone. And I thought, well, there's a sign from the universe to shut the hell up. So I did that, and I just, you know, put something up there about thinking of the people who were lost that day, 7,300 days ago. And I'm sure the people that, the families that are left behind, count those not just in days, but also in hours, minutes, and seconds since they, their loved ones passed in that the horrific terror act. At some point, you know, when you make your living in words and phrases, whether it's in print or audio, and I get stuck for that, I know it's time to just sit back and relax. So I'm even pushing myself a little bit through all this today. Yesterday, I was doing some research while I was listening to something else online. So I can read and actually take audio in at the same time. It's taken years to kind of be able to multitask that way. But I was reading a story about 9/11 and the jumpers that were leaping to their certain deaths out of the Twin Towers. And there was one particular image called Falling Man. And it's a worldwide recognized photograph of a man plummeting from one of the World Trade Towers to his death. And for years, they tried to figure out who this guy was. And when they were, you know, it could have been this person, it could be that person, might be this guy. And really, it's indicative, I guess, or representative of all the people that did that, that chose to leap to their death as opposed to being crushed or burned. You know, in their final moments, they made that decision. And I'm reading this article, which was very good, online, and about three quarters of the way through, I was actually eating at my lunch at the same time. So I'm eating lunch and I'm listening to audio and I'm reading this article. And when I got about three quarters of the way through, I had to stop eating. I got sick to my stomach. Literally, I just had to put the food away. And it was an indicator to me that even 20 years later, the whole thing makes me sick to my stomach. And there's not much I can do about it except deal with it on my level. And I'm pretty sure that 9/11, at least for our generation, is one of like caused a mass PTSD event. You know, we subscribe PTSD, and rightfully so, to those who are in the military and have seen things that shouldn't be seen and done things that they can't talk about. And that's true. And then there's other levels of PTSD, like watching people leap to their death, and there's nothing you can do about it. So I think that in so many ways, this post-traumatic stress 20 years later even, and everything in between this, which I'll get to in a few minutes, is one of the underlying causes of all the shit that still goes on in the world. You know, not able to rectify, qualify, quantify, or clarify stuff that is totally beyond our comprehension. And listening to the recounting of some of the 9/11 events from people who lost loved ones and friends and family members in the attack, you know, to see them struggling, knowing that, you know, you never get through this stuff. You just keep going into it over and over again, hopefully at some different level of understanding and consciousness, which eludes most people, even with therapies and even with talk sessions. And it is just beyond comprehension. When something's beyond our comprehension, it causes deep, deep trauma. And I'm convinced of this. I think a lot of the angst that is in our country today is already built on a whole kind of shit that was there before. And adding this to it certainly creates a void in us that is very, very difficult to fill and figure out. So on 9/11, 2001, I was on the air for 6-7 hours that day. I usually went on the air at 3 o'clock. Rush Limbaugh was on from noon to three. I'd pick it up from 3 to 6 in Michigan and in a few syndicated markets. And that particular day, Limbaugh was not on the air. I don't know who they had filling in for him. I don't recall. But when these attacks took place, I'd already called my father early that morning before this all happened because it was his 66th birthday. My dad's birthday was on 9/11. And I called. I don't even think he had, you know, voice messages or anything. There was nothing like that at his house. So I didn't get an answer from him. And I just said I'd call him later. And then I got on the phone with my friend Jeannie Weissman in Chicago. We were talking back and forth. We were literally on the phone together when she's like, you need to turn on the Today Show because there's something going on. And so that's where it all started. But as I mentioned, I was usually on the air from 3 to 6 in the afternoon, Limbaugh on noon to 3. He wasn't there. By 10 o'clock that morning, this was not just some random accident. I remember clearly either Matt Lauer or Katie Couric talking about that it's possible a plane went into the Twin Towers, one of the towers. And they didn't know if it was a private plane, an accident, whatever. But it became apparent really quick. This was a much bigger thing than maybe initially thought. So I got in the car and I drove to the radio station. And on the way in, I'm listening to the guy that was filling in for Limbaugh, and he was just not helping at all. You know, the world's coming to an end, and you know, because there was not enough information really to make those kind of judgments. And adding to that injury that's already taking place was not, in my opinion, not what needed to be said. This guy was, you know, hellfire and brimstone, and this is our, you know, it was beyond my comprehension. Again, I could not tell you who they put in his place. And while I'm not a fan of Limbaugh's politics, he was a very good broadcaster, and I think he would have handled that very different. But anyway, he wasn't there. And so by the time I got to the radio studio, like 10:30, the GM and I sat and talked, and he said, listen, we're going to cut away from this idiot who's just making things worse and stoking the fires, whatever those would be, no pun intended, and I want you to, you know, get on. And so we both felt it would be more important to have a familiar voice in people's ears as opposed to whatever was coming through there at this point. So I probably got on the air around 11. I probably stayed on the air till 6, 7 o'clock at night. And, you know, when I first got on, within a few minutes, my producer, Anne Marie, showed up. I believe we just stayed there straight through. We had some coffee brought in or whatever, but we didn't leave. You know, we just glued to the microphone. And as updates would come in, I'd either read them or we would cut away to the network, whatever. But it was very regulated, because the worst thing you can do in the middle of something like this is give out a ton of wrong information and get people even more fearful. I certainly wasn't downplaying and saying, ah, it's no big deal, let's talk about sports. But I just felt it needed to be tempered in a way that it did not exacerbate, which was already a horrific situation. And so finished up that, did the best we could there. I'm driving home, and total silence on the streets. Total silence. Like ghost town. And I remember stopping 4 or 5 times at various businesses. The doors literally, it was like something you see in an apocalyptic movie, that the doors were open, lights were on, everybody's gone. And these businesses all had flags that were flying. And I felt, as a veteran, as an American citizen, I just was compelled to stop at these businesses and lower the flags to half-mast. And it was like I just compelled to do that. And I did that 4 or 5 times, and as I was coming back around towards the main highway, there was a huge church there, and there was no parking spots available. It was overflow on the lawns. So there's nobody on the streets, and the church was packed. Matter of fact, all the churches I drove past, 3 or 4 on the way home, they're packed. But this particular church, the doors were open. The front doors were open. It was almost like a Norman Rockwell type scene. There's just cars everywhere, this white steeple church. And the doors are flung open, and all I could hear was the singing of some hymns. And it just was all surreal to me. And so I pulled into the parking lot, and there was a man sitting on the front steps of the church with a you know, like the old guys kind of tilt their cap a little bit, their ball cap, and this ball cap said Vietnam veteran. And this man was sitting on the steps of the church sobbing. I never forget it. And in a total instinctive move, I parked my car, I got out, I walked up, and we just hugged each other for what seemed like an hour. It was probably 10 seconds. And the church was there, and the doors were open, and this man and I are on the steps, and the choir and the people are singing. And it was an overwhelming pall of sadness and fear, quite frankly. So I drove home. And I got to the house, and of course, my wife at the time, you know, had the TV on all the time, the whole day, and my kids were 10 and 13. My son was 10. My daughter was around 13 years old, I guess, 12 and a half, 13. And I just had this overwhelming urge to do something normal. My stomach was starting to flip. After being on the air for 6, 7 hours and holding that position and trying to, you know, be professional as I could, the human part of me was starting to kick in about what had happened. And I was like thawing out from the shock that was, you know, had set in. And I needed to do something normal. So I got my son Andy, and we went out in the yard, and we just started throwing a catch, having a game of catch. And just, you know, he was, knew something was up, but of course at 10, you know, it's not readily made available to talk about yet, because it's still so much unsaid and undone and uncertain. But just playing catch with my son as it was getting darker was somehow like a balm on the wound a little bit, that this was, that it was still, there was this normalcy there, even though we had no idea what was going on. I think it's the first time, and maybe the last time, that I've ever been scared. Like a fear of uncertainty. I'm pretty sure of myself. I've been in some pretty interesting situations without any qualms or fears. But this was different. And you know what I'm talking about as you listen to this. This was different. And let me just say this. I have to steer clear. I'm choosing to steer clear of the motives, the conspiracy theories, all the shit that's inevitably the fallout from these type of events, wherever they may occur and whatever they might be. I have nothing to say about that because I don't know anything about that. All I know is what I've observed from my own experience. And so my focus on this podcast is how that day was for me. And that's what was resonating, you know. And to this day, whenever I go up to spend time with my son, I'd like to get a game of catch it. It reminds me of a 9/11. But it was interesting as well that on 9/11, my scheduled show for that day was with my good friend, the late, great Wayne Dyer. And, you know, author of, I don't know, 30, 40 books, who knows, speaking all over the world. The man owned PBS, basically. And he was a teacher of all things. I believe at one time he was called the grandfather of motivation or self-improvement, which I don't think he really liked that title. But he was basically a guy who, you know, started to study life, and life began to work on him, and he became a great author and speaker and, you know, a pretty phenomenal human being and a good friend for many years. And he passed, I think I'm saying 4 or 5 years ago at this point now. But anyway, on 9/11, Wayne was scheduled to be my guest at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. With his new book out called There's a Spiritual Solution to Every Problem. So here we have on 9/11, this biggest problem that we've ever had. Prior to that was probably Pearl Harbor, but certainly in my lifetime, the biggest problem that affected across the board. You know, JFK gets assassinated, RFK gets assassinated, MLK gets assassinated, that PTSD starts kicking in. And then we have years later this thing at 9/11, 3,000 people dying in minutes, really. And so the fact that that book was out on that day, and here we are dealing with this, was more than a coincidence to me. So obviously we didn't have Wayne on the show. Anne-Marie found him in a hotel in San Diego or something, I believe. And we rescheduled him for 9/14, which is 20 years ago today. So I thought there'd be some value in running a clip of that show and seeing what lessons might be extracted 20 years later. Wayne's gone. All his books are still out there. I highly recommend them as reading material if you're interested in digging a little deeper into yourself and the world that you live in. He's a great advocate and author for that and spokesperson for that and teacher for that. And also Steve Rizzo. Joined us. Steve was a new friend at the time. We've known each other 20 years now, but at that time, he'd probably done my show maybe once or twice at that point, and I knew he had something special to offer. His work as a stand-up comedian and a stand-up motivator, just incredible. He had a book out called Becoming a Humor Being, a play on becoming a human being, and he joined us on the road from somewhere. His plane had been grounded because there were no flights for quite a while, so he was like in Oklahoma City or something. And I had these two guys on for a while. And what I've done is I've gone in and taken out about 12, 15 minutes or so maybe of what I thought was the best of what we talked about at that point 20 years ago. And thinking about the immediacy, the reactionary pieces for all of us, you know, what that was like, what it sounded like back then, where these guys were at then, what they were talking about. And the thing that sadly is most resonating or jarring to me is my voice. I sound like I'm in high school. You know, I was a full-grown man doing the show. I was 42 years old at the time, and I think you have your voice, but my voice has dropped about 6 octaves in 20 years. I don't even smoke. So it's a very interesting thing. Whenever I go back and listen to these old shows, I hear this guy that to me sounds like, you know, Pinocchio or something. And it's so strange. But that's me. And that's who I was at the time. Matter of fact, real quick, I have this friend of mine, Dan Creeley, who has been a friend for decades. And he visited a gentleman in New Mexico, I believe it was, years ago, and the guy was talking about, you know, there's three voices in our lives, sometimes four, and those voices change as we mature. So I think I'm on my fourth voice. You know, if you listen to the early stuff, it's like, who gave the eighth grader a radio show? So anyway, keep that in mind as I air this clip. This is from 9:14:01, and I'll come back on the other side with some few final thoughts.
In a time when millions of people in the United States of America are grasping to get some connection to what happened in New York City and in Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, here in my own backyard, I started going through the people that I thought had a real connection to looking at the larger picture and the ability to extract and to pass on to those that are grasping some bits of information, some perspective that may in some way, shape, or form, alleviate some of the suffering that goes on in the world. Wayne Dyer is a best-selling author of 20 books and has a doctorate in counseling psychology. He lectures across the country to groups numbering in the thousands, and he appears regularly on radio and television. He joins us this afternoon on the road from San Diego, California. Good afternoon, Wayne.
Good afternoon. How are you, John?
I'm doing well, my friend, and you?
Great, thanks.
This new book that I have in front of me here is not actually out on the bookshelves yet, and it's called There's a Spiritual Solution to Every Problem, and your last book was called Wisdom of the Ages, and it comes out sitting here in front of me at a time when, if this is not the greatest challenge for us to find spiritual meaning in a tragedy, I don't know what is.
Yeah, I think you're right. By the way, it is out now.
It is, okay.
Yeah, it's just come out last week.
Mm-hmm.
It's based on the prayer of St. Francis, and I went to Assisi, I spent some time there. Francesco, who San Francisco is named after, was a celibate little monk who lived for 45 years and died as a saint. 2 years later, he was declared a saint in the Catholic Church. That usually takes three centuries. And what he said to us was, what's the chapter title for each one of these chapters? He said, Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. You know, where there is injury, pardon. And then he talked about where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is sadness, joy. We have a lot of despair, a lot of sadness, a lot of hate in the world. And what will nullify it will not be more of the same. Mm-hmm. What he was teaching us was an 800-year-old technology.
Mm-hmm.
That when you're in a dark room, you don't have to announce to the darkness that you're going to bring a candle in, and the darkness better scurry. When you bring light to a dark room, the darkness dissolves. It's nullified. It can't survive.
Right.
And it's a metaphor for our lives. When we bring love to the presence of hatred, when we look within ourselves, deep within ourselves, and find the place within us that is our highest good, we don't want to react in the same way as those who have reacted in the lowest form humans can act.
Mm. Wayne, when you heard this on Tuesday, what were your immediate thoughts and reactions to what you saw?
Well, John, I really see myself as a global person. I've never really seen myself as an American or even as a man or as... an older person now, turning in my 60s,
yeah.
And so on. I've never put those kind of labels on myself. I have been as saddened in the last couple of months that over a million people have died in the Congo in these horrible atrocities and wars that are going on there, that 500,000 people down in Indonesia have been slaughtered by Muslims and Christians fighting each other, that there are suicide bombers in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv all the time, that all of these kinds of things, and because this happens to be closer to home,
mm-hmm.
doesn't change anything for me. It doesn't make me feel any less, or any more outraged than the fact that it could be occurring anywhere. As John Donne said in his famous prayer, in his poem, every man's death diminishes me.
Mm.
He said, therefore never ask for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee, that every single act of violence and hatred and bitterness and anguish and all of and revenge and all of these represent what I call in this new book. I call them lower energies,
mm-hmm.
and slower energies, and we need to bring a higher and a faster and a spiritual energy to the presence of these things. And like light to darkness, it will nullify it. And I watched the Speaker of the House on TV last night, and And he said, let's take a moment of silence. And everybody bowed their head. And the reason that in moments like this that we take a moment of silence is because, you know, God's one and only voice is silence, as Melville said. And we really can't, in our own physical worlds and in our own bodies, we can't even begin to know how to handle people jumping out of windows to their death, or buildings crumbling with thousands of people inside of them being just turned into ashes. We don't know how to deal with that in our consciousness. So what we do is we turn it over to God and say, help us to deal with this.
You know, it's interesting. There's been in the last probably 25 years, especially, the steady growing bickering and infighting about, you know, prayer in general, where it's allowed, where it should be, where it shouldn't be, and all of that. And it's always astounding whether it's, again, it's closer to home. Our only reference for most people is what happens in our borders. And whether it's the Oklahoma City bombing or this now or whatever it may be, it always comes back to the same thing, that people always cry out God's name. And then we kind of forget, and we fall asleep a little bit, we get distracted, and next thing you know, we're fighting over it again. And then something big happens, and we all go back to it again. Do you see this? I mean, this has been going on throughout history, though. This is really nothing new.
And it's indicative of where we turn to in moments of crisis. You know, there's one of the great teachings in the Kabbalah is that every fall of our lives provides us with the energy to propel ourselves to a higher place. And you can see that. You can see that in the amount of unity that there is in the country now. I mean, this is a collective fall.
Yeah.
And you can see people, and the stories are just endless on TV of people sacrificing their lives, acts of valor, people not caring about being fatigued, everybody coming together, breaking out spontaneously, singing Amazing Grace, people doing meditations and prayer, people helping each other, being kinder, because basically our instinct within us as human beings is to see ourselves not as human beings, as I've said, having a spiritual experience, but as spiritual beings having a human experience. And in that sense, you know, when you go to sleep tonight and you look at your fingernails, you wake up in the morning, you'll see that they're a little bit longer. Well, there's a force in the universe that grows your fingernails, and it also grows everybody's fingernails. Mm-hmm. Everybody grows everybody's hair. It beats everybody's heart. There's only one force in the whole universe that's doing all of this, and that force is a force of love, and it's in our minds that we have abandoned that force.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the whole basis behind this book, that we have to change our minds. As Einstein once pointed out, you can't solve a problem with the same mind that created it. We have to look at within ourselves in order to say, how can we move away from all of this hatred and bitterness and anxiety and so on, and into a higher, faster, more spiritual place? That's why I wrote this book, and it's amazing that it's out at this time.
I know I told you before you came on the air. Now, you were on the Today Show last week.
Right.
And you're expecting them to, I would imagine, haul you back pretty quick.
Well, they called my publisher and asked if I would be willing to come on next week, so I'm waiting for that phone call now. But to me, it's just a wonderful blessing to be able to go on and talk about let's find within ourselves the ability to transcend and go way beyond the worst behaviors that human beings engage in, which is to hate others and to bomb others. And let's not go out and kill a whole lot more of innocent people to prove that you can't kill our innocent people. We'll kill yours to prove it. Let's look within. Let's hold the people who did this thing responsible, obviously, and let's seek them out, and let's make sure that these kinds of organizations don't flourish in the world. But let's look at our own selves as well and ask how much peace, how much love, how much kindness do we export in contrast to how much of the opposite that we export.
It reminds me of when you have cancer in the body and they go in and they say, here's where the cancer's at, and they don't kill you because of that. They go in and remove it.
Right.
And I was thinking that, with all the radiation and a lot of times the body gets sicker because of all the stuff that's done around that, as opposed to removing, the cause. And I think that's what we're talking about. We've been taking a lot of different views on things. A lot of the people that have been guests on the show and continue to be guests on the show are from the New York area. Steve Rizzo is one of those guys. Been doing radio with Steve for about a year or so, and he is the author of a book called How to Become a Humor Being. He was on his way to a talk in Salt Lake City and abruptly had to land in Omaha, and they made a pretty hasty landing down there. We thought we'd give his perspective as well while you're with us. Okay, Wayne?
Sure.
All right. He joins us this afternoon from Omaha, Nebraska. How you doing, Steve?
I'm doing fine, my friend. How are you?
Very well. Good. I'm glad that you are safe and sound. That's important in our view of things.
I'm glad also.
And say hello to Wayne Dyer, who's joining us from San Diego.
Hello, Wayne. How are
Hi,
you today?
Steve. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks.
Great.
Steve, have you talked to your family back home?
I've been on the phone constantly.
Mm-hmm.
My nephew worked in the World Trade Center, and he was on the stock exchange on the bottom floor, and when the plane first hit, he called up to see if his friends were okay and his boss, and they said, yeah, we're fine, we just can't get down, but they told us that they're sending help soon. And he hung up, and 15 minutes later, the entire building fell down, and they were all killed. So he saw everything firsthand,
mm-hmm.
and it really wasn't a good sight at all for him, good experience for anybody there, right. But I thank God that he's safe, and it's just an incredible thing. And as you folks were saying earlier, it's amazing how it takes a tragedy like that to for everyone to come together. And everyone all of a sudden finds their spirit, they find the higher selves, and it's amazing what you do. You don't even think. You automatically respond to helping someone as if it were an extension of yourself. You know, it's like you're almost saving your own life by not thinking, by saving somebody else's. And there were people that ran back into the fire to save people who were having heart attacks, and the person was saved, but the person who was doing the saving wound up dying.
Yeah.
They don't even think. They automatically respond to this way of doing things. And I think that's incredible.
Well, you know, as Wayne was saying before, we in this country, we are so insulated from what's going on in the world. Bill Curtis was going to be joining us today. He couldn't physically bring himself to talk about it because here's a guy that travels the world. You see him on A&E every night. He talks about investigative reports. He's been doing environmental work for a long time. He actually came up and spent some time with us up here in Michigan. And he's been saying, until something happens in this country, we have deaf ears and blind eyes. I guess I didn't really finish, Wayne. What I was saying before is, what is there any... I know your answer to this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Is there any pressure whatsoever to feel like you're going to be able to bring this message to people that will change things? Is there any pressure to that whatsoever? Because people are hungry now for something that's going to set them in a new direction.
No, I don't feel. I never feel any pressure. I really don't feel like I'm even doing this. I just really feel like I'm. I just go where I'm sent and do what I'm told, Shakespeare had a wonderful line. You know, he said, "Go to thy bosom, knock there, and ask your heart what it doth know." Ask your heart, and my heart directs me to speak about these kinds of things. I know there's an enormous amount of pressure on people in this country to retaliate, to go out and to nuke them. I've even heard a senator. United States Senator speaking about if we have to kill their innocent people, we'll do it. They didn't care about ours. That I know that there's people in all walks of life who have that kind of a mentality. I really believe that the problem itself is hatred. It's not who hates who, but it's hatred itself. And that when you join into that kind of energy, and I believe in the message of the greatest spiritual teachers who've ever walked among us, in every religious persuasion, whether it's Jesus or Buddha or Muhammad or whomever, that these are these were people who were teaching us to find within ourselves, and it's particularly in times of evil that even Jesus said, "Resist not evil," because he was saying that there really is there's only one force in the universe. It's just it's a force that's going in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just turning it around, changing our mind, finding the peace within ourselves, and delivering it that will transform the world. I believe that. I know it to be true, and I don't think that more killing is going to solve the problem of killing. I think that more love will.
Wayne, are we at that time where this can go a whole new direction? I mean, you know, they always say, if you always do what you've always done, you'll always get what you always got. And we have not been around very long in this country, 200 some odd years. Is this a pivotal time for us where we can really find a new way?
I think there's no other choice to make anyway. That is the way humanity has to go. You look at something like the Holocaust, for example, and you look at all of those people that were tortured and all of those people that went to concentration camps, and you think, why would they have to do such a thing? And yet something comes up a generation or two later called ethnic cleansing over in Yugoslavia and the Balkans, and the whole world is outraged. And we remind ourselves of what happened on this planet when we cleaned out those concentration camps, and the word was out that never again, we'll never allow such a thing to occur again. And we brought it to a halt. I mean, the world's pressure brought it to a halt. To me, that means that those people, as horrible as it was, didn't die in vain, that we grow from these kinds of things. And, you know, we were exploding nuclear weapons into the atmosphere, you know, when I was just a young man, and assuming that this was all okay. We were doing it over New Mexico. We were doing it out in the Pacific, you know, and all these mushroom clouds and radiation going into the atmosphere. And we began to realize that this is a horrible thing. Then France decided just a short time ago to do an underwater nuclear explosion, and the entire world decided that they were going to boycott all French wines, and that the protest was so strong because we grow from the kinds of mistakes that we've made in the land. And this thing here in New York, along with so many of the acts of terrorism, will bring out the very best in all of us.
So that's what it sounded like 20 years ago. I told you my voice was just a little bit different. And Wayne's observations of all that had just taken place, you know, just a couple, 3 days earlier, you know, he stuck to this whole idea that this is a collective we're all part of, and that we all contribute on some level to what happens here by our actions and by our non-actions, by what we say and what we don't say, you know. And I think of that quite often. He's been a big influence in my life as far as looking at things in a very holistic global way. Talked about, you know, I see myself as a world citizen. Doesn't mean he's any less an American. He just sees himself in a broader spectrum. And I, over time, have become of the same mindset. I can't tell you how proud I am and how blessed I feel to be dropped off in the United States of America as my landing pad and my launch pad at the same time. Also, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, I've spent a year talking to people in Beijing, China, who aren't any different than the people I know here. And that gives me great comfort. Now, that being said, doesn't mean I condone everything that another country does. That's not the point. But conversation can lead to transformation mixed in with some inspiration. And I've always maintained that that's my job, to some way, somehow, as I start these shows, find the obvious buried in the absurd and try to make sense out of the senseless. Otherwise, it's just a bucket of shit every day. And I am convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that we weren't born just to have a bucket of shit every day. Not too long ago, I did an alumni event with a few hundred of my fellow alumni from Schurz High School in Chicago. And all of our efforts financially are to benefit STLS kids for the most part. We do some other things with some other programs for Schurz High School here in Chicago. But the main focus is for STLS kids, which are students living in temporary situations. The other term is homeless at varying degrees and levels. When I went to school, there was no such thing. They may have been there, but we didn't know about it. But now, 20,000 kids in the Chicago public school system are classified as STLS. High school's tough enough, right, to get through that, all the peer pressure and shit you got to go through. But these kids have an extra layer that they got to deal with. And so we raise funds to do the simplest of things, get them clothes, get them hygiene materials, whatever some things they may need to take the edge off a little bit so they can move forward. Those kids have no idea who we are. Zero. They'll probably never see us or meet us. Ever. But here we are, doing what we can do to push back on the erosion of life that they have to deal with. And if it's a simple matter of raising a few thousand bucks to make sure for the next year or so that they're covered, then we feel obligated to do that, or at least encouraged to do that. And we've been doing it for 8 years. So that's our way of balancing things out. Can't do anything in the macro. Sometimes the micro is the way to go. And I say that keeping in mind that there, as with all things, there's a ripple effect from everything that happens in our lives. Sometimes we see it, and sometimes it takes years to see it. You know, when you go down to a pond or a river or the lake and you throw a pebble in or a stone, those ripples cascade out. They're called concentric rings. And those rings spread out and spread out and spread out. Pretty soon you can't even see them, but they still exist. But not only do they go out, they go down and they go up. And everything that happens in this world, and I'm taking a little bit out of Dr. Dyer's thesis here, you know, it affects me some way, somehow, even if it's way over there. It somehow affects me here. I'm not a New Yorker. Matter of fact, because of the Cubs losing to the Mets in 1969, I'm not a fan of New York, so go figure. But that day, like has been said, we were all New Yorkers. We were all part of the Pentagon. We're all part of Pennsylvania. And we feel the ripple effect of what happened. 20 years later, we're still feeling the ripple effect of what happened. And I, on many levels, and I came across this article from Brown University, the cost of its global war on terror, as I mentioned, $8,900,000 deaths, according to a new report from the Cost of War Project at Brown University. It was founded more than a decade ago at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs, and released its influential annual report ahead of this past 20th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks in New York City, Washington, Pennsylvania, and it is the impetus for an ongoing American effort to root out terrorism in the Middle East and beyond. And they go on to talk about how long this has gone on. We all know it's two decades, that the war continues in over 80 countries. And the message of this project is to not only just say this is what happened, but here's all the costs involved. These are the things we can measure. The research team, $8 trillion estimate for all accounts for direct costs of the country's post-9/11 wars, including the Department of Defense, overseas contingency operations, funding, the State Department, war expenditures, the Pentagon-based budget, care for veterans to date and in the future, Department of Homeland Security spending, and the interest payments on borrowing to fund these wars. The total also includes funds that the Biden administration requested just this past May 2021. The death toll, standing at an estimated 897,000 to 929,000, includes U.S. military members, allied fighters, opposition fighters, civilians, journalists, and humanitarian aid workers who were killed as a direct result of this war, whether by bombs or bullets or fire. It does not, the research has noted, include many of the indirect deaths on the war of terror as caused by way of disease, displacement, and loss of access to food or clean drinking water. And so it goes on to talk about how 20 years from today, so 40 years after this event, we'll still be reckoning with the high societal costs of the Afghan and Iraq wars long after, hopefully, the U.S. forces are no longer there. So, not getting into the whole withdrawal process, it's beyond my comprehension and consideration. I got nothing to say about that, meaning it would just be an opinion like anybody else's. I couldn't, you know, make heads or tails of that. It could have been worse, could have been better, I don't know. But I do know this, that that's the cost on paper. Those are the dollars that don't make sense sometimes. They're on a spreadsheet. But as I've mentioned on the show a couple of times, I have friends who've lost their sons in this global war on terror. They paid the ultimate price. And their cost of war could never be judged or written out or done on a computer. It just would never add up. There was no way. There's no way to qualify it or quantify it. So what's left for us? You know, after 20 years, it's going to basically, it's like pulling weeds, and pretty soon you stop pulling weeds. What happens? The weeds take over. And I don't have an answer for that either, except that I know that the old adage of if you always do what you've always done, you'll always get what you've always got holds true in every situation. And so here we are 20 years later. Trillions spent, nearly a million gone from the face of the planet, and not much has changed on certain levels. And so here we are as this species trying to figure this shit out, the shit we stir up, and then trying to clean up the shit we stir up. And it goes on and on and on and on and on. And the one thing that was I wrote about the other day that I never got to put in print was this grace period that took place in the immediacy after 9/11. If you recall, there was the Congress singing on the steps of the White House and all that stuff. And I don't even know if it was the White House. They were House representatives. They were there singing, I think about 150 of them, both sides of the aisle. And that's all well and good. Singing songs is great. Waving the flag's great. Marching is great. Being a great patriot is great. But that's just the big show stuff. Look how it's descended in 20 years. I keep thinking what it might have been like if we had Facebook or social media in 2001 as we do now. Would we have been together? Or would it be as it is today? Every single thing under a microscope gets blown up and blown apart and people move away from each other as opposed to each other, towards each other. In the last 20 years, there are a lot of lessons to be considered. But I think the one that is paramount for me is, as Wayne said, we're all in this together. You may not like it. You may not understand it. But it's only until we put aside those divides and find some commonality that we can actually ever move forward. We just keep moving further and further apart. My job has always been, as I mentioned, is to do what I can to use this microphone to close the gap between people. It is so freaking easy to push people apart. I could say one word now and half the people listening would never listen to me again. Whether I meant it or not, it's not relevant. I could just say a couple things and have, oh, he's this, and I'm gone. And the other would be like, yay. You know, for years, I had people say, thank you for being such a great voice and being a staunch conservative. And then the very next email or the very next phone call, people say, thank you so much for holding up such great liberal policies and, you know, viewpoints. What? Saying the same thing, people running everything through their own bias. That's the way of the world. So I do my very best to stand in the middle because I can see kind of both sides of things as opposed to just one. And as I said, you know, if you just take the viewpoint on one side of the fence, you live a this or that existence as opposed to being a this and that existence, which is far more powerful. 20 years later, I choked on my lunch because I saw an image of a man who's been gone for 2 decades, and it still affected me that way. And it probably always will. It should. It should. Because the loss that we felt is from the human family. And when you lose a member of the human family and you don't feel it, that's an even bigger problem. We are in the middle of a global pandemic. I thought we were out of it. We're back in it. We're basically in the middle of it. 100 years ago, they were going through the same thing. Go back and look because you have time. You should make the time to look at what the world was like in 1918, 1919, 1920, what was going on with the flu at that point. It's an exact duplicate of what's going on now, just a different disease. Exact. Same thing. We don't move forward very quickly. We're pretty slow-moving creatures. For all our great technology and all the commercials about if you just get this cell phone, your life will be better. I find it fascinating, actually, that they now have flip phones back out. Gee, what a great innovative idea. And if you just have these things, somehow life is good. But really, when it all said and done and the dust settles, that shit doesn't matter. What matters is what you decide matters. And 20 years after 9/11, lest we forget. Because the more we forget and the more divided we get, the weaker we become as a nation. Take care of yourself and each other. Until next time, safe travels. Adios.